Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
Hush Gardner, this is Dinky Dawson calling you. Are you there, sir?
I certainly am. How you doing, Dinky?
Good. I'm going to welcome you to Two Pints in the Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony's getting well right now, so Peter Limbo has been with me for a few weeks and having a great old time in here talking about the channel and the people that played there and the people that are calling and talking like you, for one. We had Gary Shea a few weeks ago, and I found out that the first time you ever played the channel was on January. September 2nd, 1980.
God, we were all young. We were all young back then.
Now, we sure were.
So I know it was you were more excited because you were just from 79, just started New England and stuff, and were having a great old time on the road doing lots of different gigs. It wasn't just the channel, but we want to talk about the channel. So do you remember that, or do you remember the first gigs you ever went to in the Channel Club?
Oh, my God. I went to I practically lived at the Channel, man. It's like I saw so many bands there. It's like, you know, many of the Boston musicians at the time, you know, we were all gigging and on the road and quite busy. But whenever we were off the road and whenever we had – you know, some spare time, we were always hanging out at all of the amazing Boston rock and roll clubs, and the Channel was, you know, the premier club in the town. I mean, the Channel was great. Paradise, Bunratty's, Cacades. I saw many bands there. The first gig that New England played, I was actually quite thrilled to be at the Channel simply because it was kind of, you know, my hometown bar and nightclub. And all I remember was when I got up on my drum set, the riser was so high that the lighting system was like 3 inches from my head.
Great.
I'm up there in sound check, and I thought, geez, my hair is going to catch on fire.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, definitely. Especially that day, because you had big hair than all of you guys and stuff.
I still got big hair.
Hey, you're lucky, kiddo.
He is definitely the king of hair.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You're very lucky. But, no, I could see that, because I remember when I first went in there, and I went to see a group in 1980 or whatever it was, called State of Mind. I was seeing the same thing with Steve Nicoletta. He was on his drums up there. And even though he was smaller, he had, with the hair and everything, it was like, it's going to set fire to his head, this thing.
that's what it felt like. But I'll tell you, I remember that gig pretty clearly. And it was, you know, the place was wall to wall. I think that, you know, a lot of the New England, you know, fans in Boston, you know, because we were on the road for years. You know, we played all over the country, and it was rare that we played in Boston. So the Channel gig was so amazing, and the place was just packed, and we did it. We had such a great time. Several encores, and it was great to be in our hometown club, man.
That's the big thing. But also, you've been in there many, many times looking for acts to produce and things like that when you started producing and seeing how they performed live and what you could do to create in the studio with them and that kind of stuff. And tell me, and Peter, a bunch of stories about that kind of bands and stuff like that, those bands that you were watching.
Yeah, a lot of bands. Finger Paint. I remember that group. Those guys were amazing. Kind of like a new wave-ish punky type of band. And I produced those guys. Dolly Ryan was in a band called Release. I know we played there. And, of course, Axminster, which was... One of my favorite band, Pieces, another band.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that.
God, you know, I produced so many bands back then. It's people still come up to me today and say, hey, Hirsch, you remember the band so-and-so? And, you know, you produced me back then. It's like I'm scratching my hands. yeah, I think I remember your band, but there were an awful lot of bands, and the channel was, like I said, on the nights that we weren't gigging or rehearsing in our little rehearsal studio down in Braintree, I was just hanging out in the bars, man, catching all the bands and seeing what was going on.
What was your favorite night? Your favorite night that you just were out, you know, just there, just watching some of the bands that came through?
Oh, I mean, I think Axminster is one of my favorite bands, and those guys are, you know, Steve Sarah is a dear friend of mine. You know, he actually co-wrote a song with me on my latest album, which is Third Time's a Charm, which was just released on Deco a couple of months ago. Yeah, but Steve Sarah and Axminster, they're actually still together, and I think that they're going to be putting out a new album in the next month or two. So those guys were a favorite.
See, the thing that's really interesting, and all the people we're talking, including like Gary Shay a few weeks ago, you're still playing, you're still enjoying it, you're still producing, you're still making records, and you're in the store every day, I hear. And with that, it keeps you young, for one, and for two, active. And active is what you've been since you started your career in 1979 and stuff. You're a Boston person, even though you live up in New Hampshire. It's one of them times. It's you loved here in Boston, and so okay, but New Hampshire's where I can play as well and stuff, because there's a lot of people up there that love this kind of stuff up there.
Yeah, I'm a Boston boy at heart. I've lived all around the different areas of down in Braintree. Lived in Medway. Lived in Cambridge for a while, but. You know, when I came to Boston in the, 69, 70, I went to Berklee College of Music, and, you know, that's kind of, you know, Boston just sort of came my default home for the next, you know, 30, 40, 50 years or whatever it was. But yeah, you know, I find that most of the rockers that, you know, my peer group, you know, John Butcher, you know, Sal, you know, all the guys in Barry Gaudreau's band, you know, all these guys are still active. They're still working. They're still doing their music. And it's kind of like, you know, that's what we cut our teeth on back in the early days. And, you know, most of us are still doing it if we're still alive anyway.
Well, that's true. That's we're losing friends left and right. We just lost Rick Derringer. Rick actually, he played on all the early Steely Dan demos for Walter.
Yeah. Rick actually came into New York and saw the Stompers and wanted to produce them.
Yeah,
but I had already made a deal with Richie Cordell, who had just done, you know, I Love Rock and Roll for Joan Jett. And I stayed. But Rick was a great guy. We went to Possible 20 and had lunch and talked, and I was really a babe in the woods back then, and he was great. He was just a perfect gentleman, and I felt really bad when I saw that the other day.
He used to hang out with us in California and stuff with Spanky and our gang and Birdies and all that stuff. It was just a class act everywhere. Well, you look, and when he played live, he just give it all every night, no matter what. And you guys do that anyway. I mean, I've seen you go crazy on the drums quite a lot of times, but not crazy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, absolutely feeling the vibe constantly, because all your musician guys around you and what have you are really giving their all to that rhythm that you keep going. With the producing, you're producing as you're drumming, because that's what even every one of my people that I've worked with, from Mick Fleetwood to Billy Cobham to all of them, they're still producing energy they're producing the energy off the other vibe people can get and make their notes with or make their feeling with and create. And I know
you were doing this
with Alan Duches with the new album because I've worked with Alan. I've just had him master a Lou Reed thing a while ago, and he did a Steely Dan for me. He's unbelievable, friend. And him and Rose, did you go down to Deco and check out all that stuff then? Down there, did you work in the studio there or up here?
No, I do all of my work at my own studio and sent them the masters, and they just, produced it from there.
Yeah.
But, the label itself is a great label. They've got, they're really committed to the musicians that they're, that they're putting out there. And, so far we've done two videos. The first video that was released, and I hope everybody gets a chance to watch it, was actually Don't Ever Want to Lose You, which was one of the New England songs that I covered on the new album. And, the second release was one of my originals called Angel in the Sky. And so that's also out on video. So I hope everybody gets a chance to, go on YouTube or go on my Facebook page and, look up the songs. Speaking of the album, the album was interesting because it's basically broken in two. I have six original songs on the album, and I've also covered six of the New England songs that I had a large hand in. You've got Don't Ever Want to Lose You, you've got Holding Out on Me, you got Nothing to Fear. And those are all, Hello, Hello, another one. Those are all classic New England songs that were on our one of our first three or four albums. And I just, I felt like, especially with Don't Ever Want to Lose You, I've heard so many covers of that song. And every time I went to listen to a new cover, I was saying to myself, geez, I really hope these guys killed this song. I hope they really did a great version of Don't Ever Want to Lose You. And I'll be quite honest with you, I really didn't ever hear anything that people covered that I thought was like really magnificent. So essentially what I did is I just re-recorded the whole song with different friends of mine, a couple of the New England guys. I've got a bunch of my friends doing background vocals and stuff. And I really just wanted to revisit the song Don't Ever Want to Lose You because I felt I could do that song major justice and, give the people who are interested in listening to New England stuff, a really great version of the song. I'm really, really proud of the way that song turned out. Hope everybody gets a chance to listen to it. Turned out really well.
You're really high on that thing. I'm telling you, that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that because it's a good vibe that you're putting out about it. And you're proud about it. I mean, that's the thing. And everything you've been doing over the years that I've seen and heard is on the right track for Hirsch Gardner. It's it's what your heart and soul is doing. And and that's why when you're saying, okay, I really like watching Axminster, but on another level, other than the style and the same kind of genre of music that you love, what was better for you in another way by watching some of the older acts? Jerry Lee Lewis. Did you watch that? Did you watch Roy Orbison? Did you watch?
Oh my God! Of course. I mean, you are basically the same age. And when we were growing up, I mean, I grew up in Toronto, Canada, and on Sunday afternoons, I used to watch all the programs from the States, and there was one program that really, really just made me aware of great music and great performances. And it was the Mahalia Jackson Show out of Detroit, Michigan.
Wow.
And that just tore me apart. I mean, she was doing gospel music.
Yeah.
I mean, this is way before Aretha and all those folks.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
Man, so that just really, really turned me on to music. And then, of course, the Gene Krupa Story came out starring Sal Mineo. And, I was a young 16-year-old drummer, and I would, I would watch that movie. Every chance I could get, I would find that movie and watch it, and it was just so inspiring. So, that was all way before the Ed Sullivan Show and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And then, when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones came out and hit Ed Sullivan, all of us you know, that was the beginning point. That was the genesis of most of my peers' musical beginnings. Just watching all those rock and roll shows on TV, American Bandstand. It was Casey Kasem. You remember that show?
Oh yeah, yeah. So who was your favorite artist that came out of there in respect of drummers? Who was your favorite one that you, other than the ones you're just talking about, but that started in the rock stuff? Charlie Watts?
That's a really good question, and everybody asks me that, and my answer is the same. I never really gravitated towards any one of those drummers. Like, you know, Charlie Watts was amazing. Ringo Starr was amazing. And if I could capture just a little nuance from any one of those guys, that was, you know, I guess you could say that was my favorite thing to do. But I never really focused on one drummer and tried to, you know, emulate that style. I sort of tried to gather together all of the different styles. You know, my early days, I was pretty much a jazz drummer back then.
Yeah.
You know, and from there I went into rock and roll and started beating the crap out of my drums, playing really loud.
Which is what I
became known for. You know, the hardest hitting drummer around. So
I saw the sticks you used to use. that's cool because. You know, an old friend of mine was Keith Moon, and let me tell you, that guy could hit the drums and stuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, and his style was so amazing because, you know, I mean, a lot of people could say, well, he overplays. No.
No.
He played, I mean, the drums never got in the way. As much as Keith Moon played and as overplaying as he did, he never got in the way of the song, which just always amazed me.
Mm.
That his drum parts fit right in with what Townsend and Daltrey were doing.
Yeah.
And Entwistle. So, yeah, it was great.
Well, they were all copied off a group called The Creation, they copied them. The Creation had a song called Painter Man in England that was just unbelievable. And it really let it go. And this is before The Who even started. And then when they started coming through the Mod Clubs, which is one that when I first saw them, before I got to know them, it really turned me on to see and hear these guys would just play and play and play wonderful stuff and create stuff really fine. And that's what I heard when you were doing, when you first started with New England, but also when I later on, when I heard some of the stuff you were doing with individuals that you were producing. And now I was saying, well, he's got to be in the Channel, he's got to be in the Rat, he's got to be in the Paradise. Is now, what's his favorite out of the lot of them? Well, you just said it, Axminster. But I'm sure you saw some other people that you got off on. What do you think about another metal band that was very religious that came on a Sunday afternoon that threw Bibles into the audience?
And was that
Striper? Yeah, see, Striper. I was waiting. That's why I didn't go. That's what I didn't say.
Wow.
And they talk about drums and everything, but there was people that came through with cages full of drums. And that's what got me. The cages took an hour to set up, and when you got them set up, you had to try to move them to put another act on, which is impossible. And and a lot on the new music night, they'd come off to showcase their stuff, and they were playing in a massive place and having a great old time. And no one was there because it was the old new music where you get five people in and six people and whatever. But people still enjoyed what was going off on that stage.
Yeah, I used to love those new music. I used to go and just look for bands.
Yeah, to manage.
Yeah, exactly.
Today he'd be looking for the Haggis band I saw in Scotland.
You and your Haggis.
Me and my Haggises. They have a band in Scotland, the Haggises, and they're on tour. I said, Peter, you got to get them for Opia. it's manage them, you know. But it's just one of these fun things we have going about bands and music and this, that, and the other. But when you start hearing the people play, and you get the vibe. You get the vibe. Once you've got the vibe in that thing, then you know what that's coming next and all the fillers and all that stuff from the guitars or the keyboards or whatever. But all you need is a couple of notes here and there. and to fill in what was going off on the wonderful rhythm. And and you've been doing that. The last time I saw you was at a AES thing in at BC. No, it
was. Was I playing? But,
no, no.
What
you,
show was that?
You were. It was. You weren't playing. You came to the to see.
Was that Todd Rundgren? Yes,
exactly, Todd Rundgren.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, of course you were there that night. Yeah, and that was wonderful seeing Todd because, as you probably know, Todd produced the third New England album, and it was great to see him there. As a matter of fact, we talked for a little bit, and he was telling me that he was trying to put together an album at that time that was using a lot of dance music. And, of course, New England was not known for dance music, but we were straight-ahead rock and roll band. Our third album, which was called Walking Wild, had the song Walking Wild on it, which was like a straight-ahead, like 150 beats per minute, four on the bass drum. And Todd was saying to me, that was one of the songs, he said, that I wanted to try to use as a basic track to produce some dance music, because it was just like, you know, just a straight ahead rocker with four on the floor on the bass drum, and he loved that. So yeah, it was great to see him and you know, reminisce a little bit about the recording that we did with him.
Yeah, he mentioned that
out of Bearsville.
He mentioned that and stuff, or what was going on, and I said, "Yep, that's the time. That's the time when everything was." That kind of time in the '80s was very creative on many levels, and I would say that the people coming into the club were on that particular scene would never stop. They would not ever stop. They would want more of you. They'd want more of you. They'd want more of the groups that came through. You know, groups like Mass and stuff like that. They were having a great old time all the time in there. But the most popular ones. Was the Fools and the Stompers and what their rock and roll produced at that time. And they could pack the places every time they ever played. You were, like you said, it was the only place you played at after you were on tour, because you guys, Gary was saying how many days of the year you were on tour the first few years. And I think that's really good that you focused on the channel to come in there with the band. And, at the end of the day, it was the biggest club in town physically for that kind of act.
It was certainly the most fun to hang out.
Oh, yeah, really.
Hey, are you still in touch with John Fannin at all?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We all chat, and Jimmy Waldo's on the road right now with Alcatraz, and you know, Gary's got a bunch of things going on. He just put a new book out, which is really cool.
Well, you know, John and I went to high school together.
Oh, get out of here. That's amazing.
We did. He was wow. The great guitar player, and I was the three chord wonder.
Okay. There you go.
So I had a special interest in you guys.
Yeah, you were special interest in John Fannin.
Just watching a classmate make good.
He made good. Well, all you guys did. No ifs, no buts. That's why you can create it on what you're doing now. You know, you've got your name out there. You've got productions that's doing real well. You've got groups that's really happy. And I like to see them when they pull me over when I see my channel jacket. I went there. I had a good time, but I got trashed. And stuff. I said, if you didn't get trashed, you didn't have a good time. Definitely. You know.
Well, some great memories from some great times, man.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, definitely. With no ifs, no buts. Now, any of the big bands that you really liked from the old days, and you know, such as like I said, Roy Orbison, or any of the guys from the South that came through, Ricky Betts and all that crew, and whatever.
Well, you know. You know who I saw at the channel that absolutely blew my mind was John Hammond.
Was there.
Yeah, I was standing right in front of your damn speaker, Dinky, and my head thrown off.
Oh, a headbanger. Oh, wow, a headbanger.
And, And John Hammond was just, you know, I mean, when I grew up in Toronto, I was playing in Yorkville Village, and everything was blues back then. Yeah. And so it's like, I cut my teeth early on in several blues bands. I was in a band called the Blues Faction in Toronto. And any chance that I could get to see any of the famous blues artists was just a thrill and a treat. Of course, John Hammond, I don't know how or why I was at the Channel that night, but thank God I was. And he just blew me away. So that was just one of the artists that I remember so distinctly, because he was just incredible.
Yeah, he was amazing.
He was incredible, because I had him in as my opening act with Mahavishnu Orchestra in 73. And I did a lot of different shows with John with different people through that time period.
I was amazed that he was a stutterer. I mean, when he talked to you, he just couldn't speak fluently, and yet when he'd get that guitar in his hand and
it just let it flow.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, I always remember him in front of thousands of people in front of Mahavishnu at Central Park when we did the live version, the live album there. It was like unbelievable. And he opened for us, and the place went nuts. Because, you know, he's got that vibe, that constant vibe from the blues days that really worked well emotionally for everybody, you know?
Because of my blues heritage, I guess you could say, I was a Ludwig endorsee. Ludwig provided me with my drums, and I'm still good friends with Bill Ludwig, and he would invite me to Chicago a lot, you know, to pick out my new drums and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I always ended up on South Michigan Boulevard, where all the blues clubs were.
Oh, yeah.
And I would just wander down the street and wander into a club and just watch the band on stage and, you know, all these old blues guys. And it was just an amazing time, in the 70s, or, you know, early 80s. Well, no, more like the early 80s. To be in a rock and roll band and watch great music. So that was a thrill for me back in the 70s and 80s to watch the blues bands in Chicago, man. It was great.
Yeah, I did. I didn't get to the clubs. Peter Green went to the club in 1969 when we did an album called Live in Chicago at Chess. And we had all the blues people from Willie Dixon, who got everything together for us and looked after Peter at the blues club. He told Peter not to go anywhere, just to stay with us and watch what's going on. But Peter had to go to the bathroom. He went to the bathroom, and the next thing you know, there's two people following him in the bathroom. And he was able to come out because I'd gone back. What am I talking about? I lost my track. Talking about the bass player,
Willie Dixon.
Willie, yeah, we're talking about Willie. Willie went and said to Peter, to the two guys who was in there, look, if you want this guy to play something for you, you just leave him alone, don't touch him. And the guys didn't do anything. Peter got on that stage and wailed the place and blew these people away, this white boy.
Oh, that's awesome.
This white boy. It was, and then the next day, Hammy Nicks came and Jeremy Spencer's loved Elmore James. The people came. All these different people came to the session, and that's how they got the album together with all these famous musicians. It was just fantastic. But Peter loved to be able to show what he could do to a clientele that would not normally see that. You know, that they were in that heavy, heavy, heavy blues club and whatever in Chicago on that street. But I couldn't believe you were running around there. We were told not to go anywhere near the place in 69.
Yeah. South Michigan Avenue, man. Yes, sir.
Oh, my goodness. No, the only times I like to go to play in Chicago is at Chicago playground there was Aaron Russell and... Aaron was just a great promoter up there and what have you. And he sat this little girl at side of me when we were doing Mahavishnu in there. I go, she wants to look at what you do here. I'm, you know, showing her how to mix and this, that, and the other. It became Bette Midler. I didn't even know. She was sat there.
Wow.
She sat asking me all these questions about it. She was just starting to get into business. This is 1969, 70.
I'll tell you a quick Chicago story. I had Mighty Sam McClain at Buddy Guy's Club. And Sam and I, after the show, were downstairs in the dressing room talking, not paying any attention to what time it was. We go upstairs. I said, come on, time to go back to the hotel, which was right around the corner. And we were locked in. The lights are off. Everybody's gone. I'm like, how the hell are we out of here now? So I kept dialing the phone number I had, but that was an agency number. So we ended up having to call the Chicago PD to come down and get us the hell out. It was...
That's great. That's a blues club.
Yeah.
I love it.
I definitely had the blues that night.
But... Oh, yeah. Oh, that's good. Oh, this is getting good. We'll go back to another 10 minutes, and then we've got to call it. Peter's got to get back down to Cape where the traffic is, and you got to get back. You are still working at the factory, as I call it, which is the Guitar Center.
Yes, sir.
Managing the whole place and everything still?
Oh, yeah.
Well, these people who are listening to the podcast, you better go over and say hello to Hirsch once in a while and buy some guitar strings.
Yeah, buy something.
String, a couple of Hirsch's drumsticks, the big thick ones that he bashes everybody on the head with, you know? I mean, them heads, we used to have those heads from Joe Pollard out on the West Coast. He'd make these heads with the fiberglass and stuff, and they were like double thing for people like you, so you could bash the crap out of them and not worry about it.
I think I knew Joe back in the day, and he set me up with my first set of syndromes, and of course he also set me up with one of his drum heads. And
that's what I'm talking about.
I reported back to him about 3 months later. Hey, Joe. I think I'm one of the first drummers in the world to break your drum head.
Good old Joe. Yeah.
So they weren't supposed to break, but hey, what can I say? I broke one. What the hell? You know.
They were thick, and they were this, that, and the other, and they sounded good too. There's a noise in the box in the syndrome. I was the one that brought him here for Andy Bergston, who was working for me at the time, and Andy went around all the studios and started playing them with different people and showing them how they worked and this, that, and the other.
Yeah. And, well, Andy was the one that set me up. So.
Oh, that's it. That was Andy.
And we still talk about that. Whenever I see Andy, it's just like, yeah, what about those syndromes, Hirsch?
But if you can still use them, they still work. And not only that, they're still used. I mean, when I went out within a circle, we changed them to D drums so I could mix them in a different level. And the D drums on the click and stuff, and so I could get that low end down below human hearing, and that would kill you at 7 cycles. But you get the thud in your body from a massive wall of sound, which was bigger than the one I put in the channel. The channel was the stuff I built in 1972, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But it still was going in all through the 80s.
I was still in diapers.
I've been around the world with that stuff. All them big amps have been around the world. The best one was Steely Dan in 74 at the Rainbow the day after the Elephants had been on there doing their thing with the elephant dude everywhere and whatever. And we put them on stage and I nearly blew the place apart with what we were doing. And I thought, this is good. But you've got to have the feeling. You have to have the feeling. If you have the feeling of those drums... I worked in a studio doing an album called Berlin with Lou Reed in 1973, and this guy was the best producer I'd ever worked with, and that's Bob Ezrin. And Bob wanted to use the sounds that I was getting on the toms on this recordings for the album. I says, well, that, you know, it's the live stuff. I'm not using Neumanns. I'm not using this. I'm using 57s. I'm using 409s. I'm using this, that, and the other. And he says, well, let's go put them up. So I went back in the studio, took all the Neumanns down and put 57s on every tom. I put a 57 even on the hi-hat and the snare. And I said, okay, have a go. And he called up Ainsley Dunbar, and Ainsley came and played, and it was just like a complete amazing rock and roll sound. It just never stopped them. They had BJ Wilson came up and played, and I'm like, this is awesome stuff, you know. And it became a musician's album, and it's still now popular again. When before Lou passed away, he was actually doing part of that on stage, because yeah. it was that real creative stuff that would not really die down, because it was what you're creating, and then 6 years from now you go back and go, wow, that was really good. Let's do that again. And not only that, you start doing it again. You go, wow, that was good, and it's lifelong. It's gonna last forever. And I love that kind of stuff. And well, you've been doing that, Hirsch. You've been doing that for a long time now, and it's a positive thing, you know?
Well, it all starts with the drums, and if the drums are there and the drums are happening, you know, the rest of the track is just going to fall together. And so many drummers that I worked with, you know, back in the day were, you know, I was a little intimidating sometimes to drummers when they come in the studio, because I would focus on the drums first. And I would have people play to a click track, and they've never done that before. And just, so before I would actually get in the studio and record a band, I would actually rehearse with the band and the drummer specifically for a month or two, just to make sure that first day in the studio when we were recording the basic tracks, that he had his stuff together. Because if the drummer doesn't have his stuff together, like you said, it's the feel. If the feel ain't there, nothing on that track is going to work.
Exactly.
I think that a lot of the productions that I did, you know, the drummers were really happening. You know, Jesse Mayer is a good friend of mine, and he was playing the drums on the finger paint stuff. And Jesse and I, you know, we battled it out for a couple of months, and by the time he got to the studio, he was killing it. And I just remember that so distinctly, that he did a great job with all that. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff that, we worked really hard on back then to make it happen. But you're right. It all starts with the drums, man. That's the bottom line.
Did you try some new songs and stuff at places like the Channel when you were playing in New England, stuff that wasn't on record and stuff like that? Did you just try the songs out and... did you try them out in different places before you recorded them?
Geez, that's a good question. And I'm trying to remember. For the most part, the first album was pretty much all recorded. The second album, we recorded that at Intermedia, and we were actually off the road. And the third album, we recorded that with Todd Rundgren, like I said earlier. And we recorded that whole album, including the songwriting, in about 3 weeks. So
that's crazy.
We really didn't have a chance to play any new material before we actually recorded it. But once again, New England was a live band. I mean, you know, we could play, you know, we could go to any gig, not do a sound check, get on stage and play, and it would still sound like the record. And that's what we prided ourselves on. You had four really great musicians in that band. Just, we didn't have to practice. We didn't have to rehearse. We didn't have, because everything was all together by the time we got on stage and we got on tour. So.
But did you notice, did you notice this? Okay. When you went on tour, you started off real decent, but 3 to 4 days in, it clicked, and all of a sudden you're just rolling along. Did you notice that at all?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, the first tour we did, I think the first couple of days we played, we did the Paradise was one of our first gigs, and then we played with the Outlaws out at, was it Tanglewood or somewhere out there? And then I think that the next gig that we did might have been Denver. We flew to Denver, and then the next gig after that was Seattle. And by the time we were in Denver, I mean, it was together. So they actually recorded that show. And, it didn't take us long, man. It really didn't.
The reason I asked that is because when I was with the Birds and we started going out to do shows from LA all through the country and stuff, and I was out, you know, with the truck and what have you. The thing was, about the third or fourth day in, it was just like a machine. It was just unbelievable. As soon as the first note went off, everybody knew what was going on. Roger could change what song or whatever, but we had a flow of certain songs that he would use at the same, you know, throughout the set, and an acoustic part and this, that, and the other. But it just flowed. And by the, like I said, the third day in, and any of the times we were doing anything special, we'd have three or four days in a row before we did like a TV show or any kind of special show that we were showing off. And you felt you got into the vibe, didn't you, of traveling? You got into the vibe of being able to, okay, now I'm going to play this, I'm going to do that. And every day you got into something scheduled that worked really, really, really well. And that was what I was thinking, and that's why I thought, oh, okay, he's playing New England, in on tour, they're coming to the Channel, they must be lit up, you know, just, and especially when he said we don't even practice, we didn't need to because we were doing this, that, and the other. I have to say, though, Birds, with us, we practiced. We did practice there before a show. These guys would try to harmonize a lot in the dressing room, and that kind of stuff for the vocals. But when it came down to playing all the electric stuff, we'd go out to, and in LA there was this little place that we'd go to. It was a little one hall room, and we'd just play and play, learn the stuff even more, you know, and try new songs, try things that didn't work and say, well, why it didn't work on that last one is because we did this or whatever. But they'd still do it. It was fun sometimes in those rehearsals, especially with Terry Melcher and there and playing piano and we're having fun. It was creative. And that's why I like we'd be able to go out and do that. I mean, Mahavishnu just played note after note after note every night. It was like it was creative. Real creative, because each night was just more progression, and by the end of the night, everybody's like, "Wow, that was the energy that we really want," and that's the energy that we got. Thank you, God, thank you, and stuff, you know. So anyway, we want to say anything else before we close down and call it for today.
Well, I sure do. So my third album, which was called Third Time's a Charm, is available on Deco Entertainment. So that's DEKO. You can also download it, you know, at any of the major, you know, downloading sites, Apple Music and all that kind of stuff. But I really hope that people will at least, you know, check out my Facebook page, HirschGardner.com, and you know, if you get a chance to buy the CD, I think that you will not be disappointed. It's also available on vinyl. The vinyl actually sounds amazing. And, you know, the graphics and all the cover work on it are really wonderful. They did a great job. So if I can say anything at all, it's like, hey, man, go out and buy my record and support a local musician. There you go.
There you go.
Well said.
Well said. On that note, we will say signing out with Hirsch Gardner from New England and a massive producer. And we will sign out of Two Pints in the Corner. And thank you again, Hirsch, for being on this.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate you. You guys do a great job. Keep it up.
Thanks, Hirsch.